When they called on him to take their leave, Governor Nara told Taita, "I am sad to see you go, Magus. Your company has done much to lighten the monotony of my duties here at Kibui. I hope it is not long before I have the pleasure of welcoming you back. I have a parting gift for you that I think you will find most useful." He took Taita's arm and led him out into the bright sunlight of the courtyard. There he presented him with 5 pack mules. Each carried 2 heavy sacks filled with glass beads. "These baubles are much sought after by the primitive tribes of the interior. The men will sell their favourite wives for a handful," he smiled. "Although I cannot think of any reason why you would want to waste good beads on such unappealing goods as those women." When the column rode out from Kibui, the 2 Shilluk loped ahead, easily matching their speed to that of the trotting horses. They were tireless, keeping up the same pace for hour after hour. During the first 2 nights, the men rode over wide, scorched plains on the east bank of the wide, dry riverbed. In the early morning of the 3rd day, when the column halted to make camp, Merrin stood in his stirrups and gazed ahead. In the slanting sunlight, he made out a low green wall that stretched unbroken across their horizon. When Taita called Nakontu, he came to stand beside Windsmoke's head. "What do you see, old one? Are they first papyrus beds?" "They are green," Taita said. "The swamps of the Great Sud never dry. The pools are too deep and screened from the sun by the reeds." "Will they block our way?" Nakontu shrugged. "We will reach the reed banks after 1 more night's march. Then we shall see if the waters have shrunk enough to let the horses pass, or if we must make a wide circle out towards the eastern hills." He shook his head. "That will make the way to the south much longer." As Nakontu had predicted, they reached the papyrus the next night. From the reed beds, the men cut bundles of dried stalks and built low thatched shelters to protect themselves from the sun. Nakontu and Nontu vanished into the papyrus and were gone for the next 2 days. "Will we see them again?" Merrin fretted. "Or have they run off to their village, like the wild animals they are?" "They will return," Tata assured them. "I know these people well. They are loyal and trustworthy." In the middle of the 2nd night, Taita was roused by the challenge of the sentries and heard Nakontu reply from the papyrus stands. Then the 2 Shilluk materialized out of the darkness into which they had blended so perfectly. "The way through the swamps is open," Nakontu reported. In the dawn, the 2 guides led them into the papyrus. From there onwards, it was no longer possible for even Nakontu to find the way in darkness, so they were forced to travel by day. The swamps were an alien, forbidding world. Even from horseback they could not see over the tops of the fluffy seed heads of the papyrus. They had to stand in the stirrups to view the undulating green ocean that stretched away before them to the infinite horizon. Over it hovered flocks of waterfowl, and the air was filled with the sound of their wings and their plaintive calls. Occasionally large beasts crashed away unseen, rippling the tops of the reeds. They could not guess at their species. The Shilluk glanced at the tracks they left in the mud, and Taita translated their descriptions. "That was a herd of buffalo, great black wild cattle," or "That was a water goat, a strange brown creature with spiral horns that lives in the water. It has long hoofs to help it swim like a water rat." The ground under the papyrus was mostly wet, sometimes merely damp, but often the water covered the horse's fetlocks. Nevertheless, the little colt, Whirlwind, was well able to keep up with his dam. Pools were hidden in the reeds. Some of these were small, but others were extensive lagoons. The Shilluk, even though they were unable to see over the reeds, unerringly steered around or between them. The column was never forced to turn back to find an alternative route. When it was time to make camp each evening, Nakontu was able to lead them to openings in the papyrus, where the ground was dry. They built their cooking fires from bundles of dried stalks and were careful not to allow the flames to escape into the standing reeds. The horses and mules wandered through the stagnant pools to eat the grasses and plants that grew in them. Each evening Nakontu took his spear, waded out into one of the pools, and stood poised like a hunting heron. When one of the big catfish swam close enough, he would skewer it cleanly and lift it struggling, tail-whipping, out of the water. In the meantime, Nontu plaited a loose basket of reeds and placed it over his head, his eyes visible through the gaps in the weave. Then he left the bank and submerged his entire body until only his head, disguised by the reed basket, showed above the surface. He moved with infinite patience and caution to a flock of wild duck. When he was within range, he reached out beneath the surface, grabbed a bird's legs, and plucked it under. It did not have a chance to squawk before he had wrung its neck. In this way, he could take five or six birds from a flock before the others became suspicious and took off with loud honks and clattering wings. Most evenings the company dined on fresh fish and roasted wild duck. Stinging insects plagued men and animals. As soon as the sun set, they rose in buzzing clouds from the surface of the pools, and the troopers huddled miserably in the smoke of the campfires to avoid their onslaught. In the morning their faces were swollen and spotted with bites. They had been travelling for 12 days before the first man showed symptoms of swamp sickness. Soon, one after another, his comrades succumbed to it. They suffered from blinding headaches and uncontrollable shivering, even in the humid heat, and their skin was hot to the touch. But Merrin would not break the march to let them recover. Each morning the stronger troopers helped the invalids to mount, then rode alongside them to hold them in their saddles. At night many babbled deliriously. In the morning dead bodies lay around the fires. On the 20th day Captain Tonka died. They scraped a shallow grave for him in the mud and rode on. Some of those struck down threw off the disease, although their faces were left yellowed and they were weak and exhausted. A few, including Taita and Merrin, were unaffected by the sickness. Merrin urged the fever-racked men on. "The sooner we escape from these terrible swamps and their poisonous mists, the sooner you will recover your health." Then he confided to Taita, "I worry ceaselessly that should we lose the Shilluk to the swamp sickness or they desert us, we will be helpless. We will never escape from this dreary wilderness and shall all perish here." "These swamps are their home. They are shielded from the diseases that abound here," Taita assured him. "They will stay with us to the end." As they travelled on southwards, vast new expanses of papyrus opened before them, then closed behind them. They seemed trapped like insects in honey, never able to break free despite their violent struggles. The papyrus imprisoned them, ingested them and suffocated them. Its bland monotony wearied and dulled their minds. Then, on the 36th day of the march, there appeared at the limit of their forward vision a cluster of dark dots. "Are those trees?" Taita called to the Shilluk. Nakonto sprang onto Nontu's shoulders and stood to his full height, balancing easily. It was a position he often adopted when he needed to see over the reeds. "Nay, Ancient One," he replied, "those are huts of the Luo." "Who are the Luo?" "They are hardly men. They are animals who live in these swamps, eating fish, snakes, and crocodiles. They build their hovels on poles, such as those you see. They plaster their bodies with mud, ash, and other filth to keep off the insects. They are savage and wild. We kill them when we find them, for they steal our cattle. They drive the beasts they have stolen from us into the fastness of theirs and eat them. They are not true men, but hyenas and jackals." He spat in contempt. Taita knew that the Shilluk were nomadic herders. They had a deep love for their cattle and would never kill them. Instead, they carefully punctured a vein in a beast's throat, caught the blood that flowed in a calabash, and when they had sufficient, they sealed the tiny wound with a handful of clay. They mixed it with cow's milk and drank it. "That is why we are so tall and strong, such mighty warriors. That is why the swamp sickness never affects us," the Shilluk would explain. They reached the Luo encampment to find that the huts sitting high on their stilts were deserted. However, there were signs of recent occupation. Some of the fish heads and scales, beside the rack on which they smoked their catch, were quite fresh and had not yet been eaten by fresh water crabs or the buzzards that perched on the roofs. And live coal still glowed in the fluffy white ash of the fires. The area beyond the encampment that the Luo had used as a latrine were littered with fresh excrement. Nakonto stood by it. "They were here this very morning. They are still close by. Probably they are watching us from the reeds." They left the village and rode on for another seemingly interminable distance. Late in the afternoon, Nakonto led them to an opening that was slightly higher than the surrounding mud banks, a dry island in the wastes. They tethered the horses to wooden pegs driven into the earth and fed them crushed durra meal in leather nosebags. Meanwhile, Taita tended the sick troopers, and the men prepared their dinner. Soon after nightfall, they were asleep around the fires. Only the sentries remained awake. The fires had long burned out, and the troopers were deep in slumber when suddenly they were shocked awake. Pandemonium swept through the camp. There were shouts and screams, the thunder of galloping hooves, and splashing from the pools around the island. Taita sprang up from his mat and ran to Windsmoke. She was rearing and plunging, trying to pull the peg that held her out of the ground, as most of the other horses had. Taita grabbed her halter rope and held her down. With relief, he saw that the foal, shivering with terror, was still at her side. Strange dark shapes flitted around them, prancing, screaming, and ululating shrilly, poking at the horses with spears, goading them to break away. The frenzied animals plunged and fought their ropes. One of the figures charged at Taita and thrust at him with his spear. Taita knocked it aside with his staff and drove the point into his assailant's throat. The man dropped and lay still. Merrin and his captains rallied their troops and rushed in with bared swords. They managed to cut down a few attackers before the others vanished into the night. "Follow them! Don't let them get away with the horses!" Merrin bellowed. "Do not let your men go after them in the dark!" Nakonto called urgently to Taita. "The Luo are treacherous! They will lead them into their pools and ambush them. We must wait for the light of day before we follow." Taita hurried to restrain Merrin, who accepted the warning reluctantly, for his fighting blood was up. He called his men back. They assessed their losses. All four sentries' throats had been cut, and another legionary had received a spear wound in the thigh. Three Luo had been killed, and another was badly wounded. He lay groaning in his blood, and the vile matter that dribbled from the stab wound through his guts. "Finish him!" Merrin ordered, and one of his men decapitated the man with a swing of his battle-axe. 18 horses were missing. "We cannot afford to lose so many," Taita said. "We won't," Merrin promised grimly. "We will retrieve them. On Isis's teats, I swear it." Taita examined one of the Luo corpses in the firelight. It was the body of a short, stocky man with a brutal ape-like face. He had a sloping forehead, thick lips, and small, close-set eyes. He was naked, except for a leather belt round his waist, from which hung a pouch. It contained a collection of magical charms, knuckle-bones, and teeth, some of which were human. Around his neck, on a lanyard of plaited bark, hung a flint knife caked with the blood of one of the sentries. It was crudely fashioned, but when Taita tested the edge on the dead man's shoulder, it split the skin with little pressure. The Luo's body was coated with a thick plaster of ash and river clay. On his chest and face were traced primitive designs in white clay and red ochre, spots, circles, and wavy lines. He stank of wood smoke, rotten fish, and his own feral odour. "A repulsive creature," Merrin spat. Taita moved to attend to the wounded trooper. The spear thrust was deep, and he knew it would mortify. The man would be dead within hours, but Taita showed him a reassuring face. In the meantime, Merrin was picking his strongest and fittest troopers for the punitive column to follow the thieves. The rest of the party would be left to guard the baggage, the remaining horses and the sick. Before it was fully light, the two Shaluk went out into the reed beds to find the outward spoor of the raiders. They returned before sunrise. The Luo dogs rounded up their runaway horses and drove them in a herd towards the south, Nakonto reported to Taita. We found the bodies of two more and another who was wounded but still living. He is dead now. Nakonto touched the hilt of the heavy bronze knife that hung from his belt. If your men are ready, ancient and exalted one, we will follow immediately. Taita would not take the grey mare on the raid. Whirlwind was still too young for hard riding, and Windsmoke had been wounded in her hindquarters by a Luo spear, fortunately not gravely. Instead, he mounted his spare horse. When they rode out, Windsmoke whinnied after him, as though expressing indignation at having been passed over. The hooves of the 18 stolen horses had beaten a wide road through the reed beds. The bare footprints of the Luo overlay the tracks of the horses they were driving. The Shilluk ran easily after them, and the horsemen followed at a trot. The trail led them south all that day. When the sun set, they rested to allow the horses to recover, but when the moon rose, it shed sufficient light for them to go on. They rode all night with only short breaks to rest. At dawn they made out another feature in the distance ahead. After so long in the monotonous seas of papyrus, their eyes rejoiced to behold even this low, dark line. Nkonto sprang onto his cousin's shoulders and stared ahead. Then he grinned at Taita, his teeth shining like pearls in the early light of day. "Old man, what do you see is the end of the swamps? Those are trees, and they stand on dry land." Taita passed on this news to Merin and the troopers, who shouted, laughed, and thumped each other's backs. Merin let them rest again, for they had ridden hard. From their tracks, Nkonto judged that the Luo were not far ahead. As they rode forward, the line of trees loomed larger and darker, but they could not make out any sign of human habitation. At last they dismounted and went forward, leading their mounts, so that the riders' heads would not show above the tops of the papyrus. It was long after midday before they stopped again. Only a thin strip of papyrus screened them now. Then even that ended abruptly against a low bank of pale earth. It was no more than 2 cubits high, and beyond it lay pastures of short green grass and groves of tall trees. Taita recognized Kigelia sausage trees with their massive hanging seed pods and sycamore figs, with the yellow fruit growing directly on the fat grey trunks. Most of the other species were foreign to him. From the cover of the groves they could clearly make out the tracks that the stolen horses' hooves had left as they climbed the soft earth bank. However, there was no sign of the animals in the open pasture beyond. They scrutinized the tree line. "What are those?" Merin pointed out distant movement among the trees and a fine haze of dust. Nkonto shook his head. "A buffalo. A small herd. No horses. Nontu and I will scout ahead. You must remain hidden here." The two Shilluk moved forward into the papyrus and disappeared. Although Taita and Merin watched carefully, they did not see them again, not even a glimpse of them crossing the open pasture. They moved back from the edge of the papyrus, found a small patch of open, drier ground, filled the nosebags, and let the horses feed while they stretched out to rest. Taita wrapped his shawl around his head, placed his staff at hand, and lay back. He was very tired, and his legs ached from trudging through the mud. He drifted over the edge of sleep. "Be of good heart, Taita. I am close." Her voice, a faint whisper, was so clear, and the tone so unmistakably Fenn's, that he jerked awake and sat up. He looked around quickly, expectantly, but saw only the horses, mules, the resting men, and the eternal papyrus. He sank back again. It was some time before sleep returned, but he was weary, and at last he was dreaming of fishes that leapt from the waters around him and sparkled in the sunlight. Although they were myriad, none was the fish he knew was there. Then the shoals opened, and he saw it. Its scales sparkled like precious stones. Its butterfly tail was long and lithe, the aura that surrounded it ethereal and sublime. As he watched, it transmuted into human shape the body of a young girl. She glided through the water, her long naked legs held together, pumping from her hips with the grace of a dolphin. The sunlight from above dappled her pale body, and her long, bright hair streamed out behind her. She rolled onto her back and smiled up at him through the water. Tiny silver bubbles streamed from her nostrils. "I am close, darling Taita. Soon we will be together, very soon." Before he could reply, a voice and a rough touch shattered the vision. He tried to cling to the rapture, but it was torn from him. He opened his eyes and sat up. Beside him squatted Nkonto. "We have found the horses and the Luo jackals," he said. "Now comes the killing time."